You're listening to All Things Cage at Waveform's WGXC 90.7 FM radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust. My guest today is Stephen Nachmanovich, an old friend and an improvisational violinist who works at the intersections of music, dance, theater, and multimedia arts. Born in 1950, Stephen graduated in 1971 from Harvard, and in 1975 from the University of California, Santa Cruz, where he earned a PhD in the history of consciousness for his exploration of William Blake. His mentor was the anthropologist and philosopher Gregory Bateson. In the 1970s, he was a pioneer in free improvisation on violin, viola, and electric violin. He has taught and lectured widely in the United States and abroad on creativity and the spiritual underpinnings of art, presenting masterclasses and workshops at conservatories and universities. He's also made numerous appearances on radio and television and at music and theater festivals. He has collaborated with other artists across media and has developed programs melding art, music, literature, and computer technology. Stephen has also created computer software, including the World Music Menu and Visual Music Tone Painter. He's also written two books, Free Play in 1990, and most recently, The Art of Is in 2019. He lives with his family in Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome to All Things Cage, Stephen. It's great to have you.
Oh, Laura, it's such a pleasure to be here.
Stephen and I have known each other for a very long time. We were never super close friends. Stephen and I shared a friend named Ron Fine, who's a composer as well. Stephen still is in touch with Ron, and I am not, but I'm going to be because now I have his coordinate. So Stephen reemerged in my life. Stephen is a composer. He is an improviser. He's a public speaker. He's an author. He's a man about town. He's I don't know how else you think about yourself, Stephen, but Stephen has a second book out called The Art of Is. We'll put the information about it in the broadcast page so people can order it and see it. But I got this book from Stephen, actually. He sent it in the mail. I hadn't heard from Stephen in easily, I don't know how many years, 15 years. And here was this new book in the mail. And I love this book. And so I reached out to Stephen. And that's how we're here, positioned to do this program today.
Well, I wrote to you and asked your permission to use quotes from John Cage, which several are in the book. And that's how we got reconnected, really. And then I sent you the book when it came out. And Cage was an interesting weave that kept going in and out of the ideas in this book, which is really about the creative process from the outside in. Free Play, my earlier book, was about the creative process from the inside out. It was about creativity as it emerges from the human being and as it arises as a spiritual and psychological reality when a person picks up a musical instrument or just uses your voice or whatever it is that you do, and you're able to play and do something coherent without planning it or writing it down first and so on. And The Art of is about the creative process from the outside in that we are all immensely influenced by each other, by living in the city, in the natural environment, in the social environment that we're in the inner social environment. Even if you're sitting and writing by yourself alone in a room, your parents are with you, your teachers are with you, your old friends are with you, the people whose books you've read are with you, the people whose books you haven't liked are with you. You know, we're all together in this. There's one thing that I didn't put in The Art of Is, which was a famous, and it supposedly happened, encounter between two of the greatest improvisers of all time, Miles Davis and Keith Jarrett. And of course, as you know, Keith Jarrett was a young member of Miles Davis's band, which was like the ultimate graduate school of jazz in the universe. And then Keith Jarrett broke out and started doing totally improvised solo concerts on piano and really just revolutionized the music world with those concerts in the early 70s.
I remember them vividly.
Yes. Yes, it was a huge influence on me. And I was so honored that Keith wrote a wonderful blurb for Free Play. So Miles said to Keith, well, how can you improvise on nothing? And what he meant like that, for those who aren't in the jazz world, is that in jazz, there is a pre-made structure, which is really like a lattice work, and it has a lot of free spots and holes in it and so forth. But there's a chord structure, and there might be a standard tune that everybody knows. And into and over and within and without that structure, a jazz improviser plays variations and filigrees and fantasies upon that something. So that's what Miles Davis meant by a something. Even in John Cage's, you sent me his piece that he did with taking some notes that he wrote, and he crumpled them up, and then he read bits of them in random order. And that was sort of that's what he regarded as an improv piece.
But I'm sorry, what are you talking about?
Talking about this, the piece where he improvised on these 10 texts.
Oh, no, no, they weren't crumpled up or anything. Okay. They were just cards. What Stephen is talking about is a radio program that I did about Cage's piece called How to Get Started.
Mm.
And what he did was take 10 cards and write on each one a line. It might say clouds, or it might say poetry, or it might, these were supposed to trigger a kind of extemporized few minutes on whatever subject he wrote down that was of interest.
Right.
So it really was an improvisation in the sense that he used, his structure was these little notes on these cards that he created, shuffled and extemporized out of order. There was no order to them.
And when I said crumpled, I was referring to one of the first one or two of those. He was referring to crumpling up pieces of paper that had notes on them.
Right, right. Okay, sorry.
Playing with that ball. So that's true. So anyway, so Kate, so he had a something. And this is very common. Homer, whoever he or she was, improvised the Odyssey, and generations of singers of tales have improvised upon a basic story with a certain rhythmic structure and that sort of thing. So here was Keith Jarrett getting up with nothing, as Miles Davis called it, and there he was improvising on nothing. And Miles said, well, this is impossible. You have to have something. But of course, Jarrett did a wonderful job with nothing.
Right.
And that's the kind of work that I do, because I'm incapable. My knowledge of Western music theory is pathetic, and my knowledge of Indian music theory is a little bit more, but I really can't. I'm not the kind of person who's very good at following instructions. So playing scored music, even though I did that in my childhood when I was learning to play the violin, what works best for me is standing up with an audience and either playing the violin or giving a talk, and it just comes.
Right.
But the question of what is that nothing? Because nothing was a word that Cage was very interested in, you know. And from the Buddhist point of view, there is no nothing.
Exactly.
There's no such thing as nothing.
I was going to be argumentative and say there's no such thing as nothing.
Exactly. Exactly. So when I talk about the writer sitting in your room and your parents are with you and your friends are with you and the other writers are with you, or you're a musician improvising and what you heard on the radio today is with you, the music you don't like is with you, the sound of the wind is with you, the breath of the audience is with you. In Buddhism, the perhaps the most important of idea in Buddhism is the emptiness of inherent existence. When Westerners hear it translated that way, we tend to freak out because we think it's nihilism or something like that, as though they're saying, well, there's nothing. But what they're saying instead is, here you and I are talking on Zoom through two computers, and my computer is made of aluminum and plastic and glass and copper wire and silicon and all of these things. Each of these substances was mined from the earth by human beings, each of whom had their own life story. The use of the substances was invented by people, each of whom had their own life story. The geology of the earth going back 4.5 billion years is part of the story of this piece of aluminum that I'm touching now. If I'm a violinist, the wood has its past, the forest has its past, the nutrients, the water, the storms are all built into that piece of wood. So the piece of wood, the piece of aluminum, the computer is full of infinitely many stories. And those stories, human, non-human, natural, geological, biological, are part of what this is. So the only thing that this computer doesn't have is a separate, independent existence all by itself. It's not a thing. And that's why they say it is empty of inherent existence. It doesn't exist all by itself. It exists in this constant flowing interaction with everything else around it. And so by entering into the substance of the computer, you are entering into all of history, all of geology, all of physics, all of society, the labor relations of the people in China who made this thing, all of that. There is no nothing. And what does the improviser improvise on? They improvise on nothing, which means they improvise on everything in the universe. Specific, incredibly detailed stories going back 4.5 billion years.
All rolled into a conversation about what you especially like for dinner.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Make it all very rich. You know, yes. One of Cage's most popular lines, as you well know, is, I have nothing to say and I am saying it.
Yes, exactly.
That is poetry as I need it.
Exactly. And yeah. One of Cage's most, iconic episodes in his life was going into the anechoic chamber, where he expected to hear nothing, but instead he heard the operation of his own body.
Right.
Which
right.
meant, of course, he wasn't just hearing himself, he was hearing the whole 3.5 billion years of organic evolution that right. went into making such a body.
Right. He was less interested in that, though, and more interested in the fact that he was making sound when he didn't mean to.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a human being, he just said that there's no such thing as silence. No such thing. Silence for him, you know, to really for our listeners, just to be sure that this is a very clear idea, that silence wasn't anything more than the absence of intentional sound. That's all. So it's you in the forest, not making any sound, but there are lots of sounds around you to hear. That's silence for him. Henceforth,
of course, the intentional sound, there's, of course, all the wonderful recordings of 4 minutes and 33 seconds, which feature, you know, the audience muttering or something dropping or the traffic going outside or the birds or whatever the sound may be. And it may not be intentional on the part of the composer or the performer, but it certainly is intentional on the part of the people who are driving the cars and the audience members who are coughing.
Yes, but that's not the concern. That wasn't Cage's
right.
concern.
Cage's concern was the
performer.
But what he was doing was providing a window or an audio window into this unbelievable plethora of activity that's all around us and within us.
Right.
And, you know, it's like there's the famous Bishop George Berkeley in the History of Philosophy, who asked, if the tree falls in the forest and there's no one to hear it, did it make a sound? But of course, he was completely ignorant of what a forest is, which is, of course, millions and billions of creatures that all have their own sensorium and their all way of understanding and their all way of sensing. Even if the tree was standing by itself in the middle of a field, a tree is consists of millions of insects, millions of creatures, millions of mycelia, all of which have their own sensorium. And so, of course, what do you mean by sound and what do you mean by it? None of these things. There is no it. There is no tree, because the tree is a community that extends infinitely.
Yeah. All of that is to say, though, for Cage, somewhat irrelevant, because his interest was in the performer doing nothing.
Yeah.
And the intentionally looking at the impossibility of there being nothing. It's actually where you can see this pretty clearly is, you know, the 433, this piece by Cage, actually existed in three different versions. You know, it started out as a work which was notes, note values all lined up, you know, properly within border, but within bar lines, all the appropriate, you know, note heads to fill up the space, except that those were all silent. They were all rest indicators. Then the second one was proportional. So it really took time and turned it into space. So relatively speaking, if the piece is going to be 4 minutes and 33 seconds, what percentage did this take up for that movement? Three movements had to be filled. But then the last version was the so-called tacit version. And that's why that's important, because it got rid of all the unnecessary stuff around notating this piece, and just simply wrote Roman numeral one, tacit, Roman numeral two, tacit, Roman numeral three, tacit, tacit meaning in the musical sense, you be quiet while other people do things.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't mean silence. It just meant you be quiet. And the strings are doing something over here and the wind instruments are doing something over here, but you're quiet while they do that. So it really has to do with the central position of the artist doing nothing, being quiet. And then, of course, the anechoic chamber introduced the idea back to him that it happens in nature, that, you know, that you do this and you can never be quiet. You actually can't be quiet, you know, but you don't intend not to be quiet.
The thing that's interesting about that is that you make these discoveries by dialing down the knob, as it were.
Of what?
Mindfulness. Okay. So when the when David Tudor would sit on his chair and close the cover, the lid of the piano keyboard. Okay, he was, this is like, again, you know, so much of this relates to Buddhist practice. So you sit zazen, or it doesn't matter if you're sitting zazen, you and I are both sitting on chairs. So the fact that we're sitting on chairs means that we are engaged in constant self-corrective action. My body is microscopically veering over to the right a little bit, and I have muscles in my left flank that straighten it out. And it's microscopically veering over to the left a little bit, and there are muscles in the right that straighten it out. So simply sitting still on a piano bench or on a chair involves an enormous amount of dynamic activity.
Right. It's an active process.
It's an active process. It's an active process. And so to be a person who is quiet, you're simply dialing down those processes a little bit. You never eliminate them, so that you can be a little bit more attentive to what's going on out there. And that's the magic of sitting still. whether it's formalized in a zendo or formalized in a piece like 433, that you are somewhat dialing down relatively all of this muscular activity and all of this verbal activity. And then you become aware. In The Art of Is, I talked about Freud's idea. In 1912, Freud wrote a paper of instructions to psychoanalysts in which he said that you must cultivate an evenly hovering attention, which is almost identical to what Cage elicits in his work. You know, he's saying that if you that it's so easy for, let's say you're a psychoanalyst and you're listening to your patient speaking, and you it's easy to jump to conclusions about what's going on with that patient and to want to connect the dots and to want to help them and all of these active things, but thereby you miss all kinds of important things that are going on. And to basically sit back and cultivate an evenly hovering attention is so interesting. In the book, I relate that to an experience I had in 19, which actually folded back into a visit that I had with John Cage sometime in the 80s. I guess it was 84. I visited him in his apartment on 18th Street, and he said to me, you know, there was traffic going by, and he said to me, well, when I was younger, I was really interested in sounds like traffic sounds and sirens and so on. But now that I'm old, I'm interested in much more subtle sounds like the refrigerator turning on and off. And 12 years later, I gave a talk in Pennsylvania, and when I heard John say this, I was sort of inwardly thinking, well, gee, that's very nice, John, but I kind of like listening to Sonny Rollins playing Autumn Nocturne, and I don't really care for the refrigerator turning on and off. But then 12 years later, I was sleeping in a hotel room before a talk which became the chapter all about frogs. And this hotel room contained one of these crappy old refrigerators that you find in hotel rooms. And it was so annoying. And I was lying there at 3 a.m. listening to the refrigerator, and then suddenly snapped off. And it felt so good. And I suddenly remembered what John said to me 12 years ago. And I go, bam, okay, now I know what he's talking about. And then right about that time in LA, my wife Leslie and I went to a week of teachings by the Dalai Lama in the Pasadena Civic Auditorium, which is a very ornate, you know, sort of Art Deco auditorium with all the gold leaf and the giant trellises and everything. And the Dalai Lama was there with maybe 100 monks of several Buddhist denominations, all of them in these different colored robes, and they were spread out kind of like a symphony orchestra in a semicircle. And there he was giving hour after hour of talks about Nagarjuna and Shantideva and these great Buddhist teachers of the past. And meanwhile, he was being protected on this trip by the United States Secret Service. Usually the Secret Service protects, like, whatever, the president of France who's giving a 1-hour talk someplace and then drives to the next destination. So here these guys were standing there through 5 days of all day long heavy duty talks of Tibetan philosophy. So behind all these brightly colored monks sitting in their robes, there were the men in black. There was about 12 of them arrayed like at the back of the stage in a behind where the monks were spread out. And their job was to spend the whole day making themselves as unobtrusive as possible, very, very still, physically still and quiet, scanning the audience constantly for the one in a million chance that somebody might pull out a weapon. And as the Dalai Lama was talking about these very deep Indian Buddhist philosophies that underlay the practice of mindfulness, I suddenly found myself looking at the men in black and thinking that they are doing what he is talking about. They are engaging, the Secret Service was engaging in evenly hovering attention, of simply being quiet and paying attention to the environment around them with no particular expectation, but being immensely alert. And that was absolutely fascinating. So there was that wonderful collusion of the conversation with John Cage and the refrigerator in the hotel and the Secret Service protecting the Dalai Lama. And that's all about nothing, you know. So when we started with Miles telling Keith, well, how can you improvise a nothing? You know, here's the incredible richness of nothing.
Right. You know, Cage was with this whole thing about like the refrigerator or whatever. He used to talk with me a lot about how for him, he liked sounds that changed. That it didn't have to be anything in particular, but he didn't like repetitious sound. He didn't like, for example, car alarms. So, you know, somebody walks by your car and hits it and it activates the alarm, which then says blat, 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 you know, with any precision. So he liked things that changed. It didn't make any difference what it was. So it didn't have to contain anything. It just needed to change. And if I were you, I would have just unplugged the refrigerator.
Well, I have unplugged a lot of things, but I'm so glad that I usually do that, but I'm so glad I did it then, because then I had this moment of illumination.
Right.
When it turned itself off, you know,
which
is also, that's another important lesson about improvisation in life and art. Whatever your art form is the exquisite role of irritation. You know, so that when you're irritated by something, when something that you don't expect or maybe don't even like is intruding in your environment, then now your mind expands and now you change in some way. And that's really interesting.
Right. Well, you know that Cage story. If you come upon something that you think you don't like.
Right. Do it more.
Do it more.
Do it more. Yes. And of course, that's one of the greatest moments in when you do hear a performance of Cage or similar music, that when the baby starts crying or when the alarm goes off or when the thunderclap happens outside of the auditorium, you know, people just start, whoa, that fits right in. That fits right in. And that's what theater improvisers do. You know, they're constantly dealing with, of course, you know, it's become a kind of cliche for theater improvisers to say, well, we work with yes and, you know, no matter what a person or the environment throws at you, you just accept it and go with it and build on it. I kind of prefer Keith Johnston's idea of calling that chivalry.
Oh yeah, that was nice. You opened your book, you know, a bit with that, and that's very nice.
Yeah,
it's interesting, Stephen. You know, I told you, Stephen, I talked a little bit as I was reading the book, just about having a radio program together. And Stephen, like virtually everybody, you know, was under the impression that Cage just hated jazz and just didn't like improvisation. And in point of fact, that was true. I'm not negating that at all. But there was this moment in his life where he did dabble with ways of thwarting, let's put it that way, performance that thwarted the repetition or thwarted you relying upon things that you knew or that you liked or whatever. But what's really struck me when I compared the two, Stephen's book speaking about improvisation as a really hyper social event in any form that it takes, it struck me how different that is from Cage, because Cage was very, very much interested in alteration of the self. He wasn't interested in group dynamics, or at least he didn't express it. He mm-hmm. didn't express that. I think that he left the responsibility for that in the individual, in the solo person to whom he was speaking through his compositions. And I found that fascinating, you know, where mm-hmm. Stephen, I think that when everything I came across in your book, it's always about interaction. It's always about interpenetration of self with other selves. Yeah? You think that's
yes. true? Yeah. Yes, that is true. Yeah. And I mean, that's interesting. When I contrasted my books, my first book, Free Play, was rooted very much in the, even though it also dealt with social experiences and political experiences, it dealt largely with what happens when you feel that something unbidden just arises from within yourself. And when you pick up a musical instrument and realize that you can do something that's interesting and structured and satisfying without having any plan whatsoever and without having any special intention whatsoever. But what's interesting, of course, is those two things meet.
Of course, and I think that's where you're going. I think I loved this book for so many reasons, but one, this is going to sound in a way kind of as if it's hovering above the book, but I love the book because it was the first time I ever read anything on the subject of improvisation that excited me. That I mean, it really made it, it opened up the possibility that I could read about improvisation, and it was thrilling. Whereas before, it wasn't so interesting. It always felt like this kind of internal dead end. Like it was.
Oh, thank you.
It's a beautiful book for if for no other reason than that. And it's a beautiful book for many reasons. But just that one thing, it really opened up the world of improvisation to me in a way that I'd never thought about it. But I wanted to say one other thing, which you were just talking about. Now it's gone straight out of my head, of course.
That which goes out comes back in.
Yeah, I guess what I was just getting at is that Cage really believed that self-alteration was the most important thing. That mm-hmm. that if it's a very Maharishi kind of idea, isn't it? No, that through mm-hmm. transcendental meditation, the idea was that the individual is transformed, thereby it ripples out and other people are transformed. Mm-hmm. Whereas mm-hmm. yours is much more interactive. It's much mm-hmm. more energetic. Let's put it yes. that way.
And yet the self, whatever you want to call that, complicated and illusory an idea as that is, still is present in some way. I mean, the interest, you know, John Cage famously tried to get away from memories, tastes, likes, and dislikes, which of course means that he felt memory, he disliked likes and dislikes, and he had a distaste for memories and tastes. And whether it was through chance operations or any of the other methods he used, he tried to sort of distance his work from self-expression.
So that's something new could
emerge. Sense of self. Self-alteration, you know.
Right. It had less to do with suppression as it did with opening up.
That's correct.
You know.
But what's interesting is that you can walk into a room, you know, and immediately know if somebody's playing a piece by John Cage, you know it's a John Cage piece.
Of course
he had a style, you know, so every attempt that he made to get away from style, and then Keith Jarrett in a totally other musical universe, he famously, you know, just closed his eyes and sat down and started from so-called nothing. But of course you can, you know, of the thousands of performances that he gave, they all sound like Keith Jarrett.
Right, you know who that is.
Who Cage is. There's Morton Feldman, who was really one of my favorite composers and a close friend and ally of Cage, but a very different style. Mm-hmm. And you know his work.
Right.
And so every one of us has this kind of fingerprint, you know, because we are, in fact, just as the tree in the forest is this consilience of thousands and millions of creatures and influence in its history. So it is that tree.
It's interesting, though, Stephen, you know, with Cage, when I think about it, his experimentation or his tactic, let's just call it tactics.
Yeah.
To short circuit the ability to get to those memories, to get to those repetitious things that we love and want to bring out, you know, most of that, when you look at it very specifically, most of that was done by him, by the chance operations. Not so much. It's not actually chance operations. It's really more his assigning impermanent instruments to people. Mm-hmm. You know, play mm-hmm. these rocks, mm-hmm. do something mm-hmm. with this water, you mm-hmm. know, that sort of thing. Things that can't be mastered, you know, yeah. that or that will fall apart when you engage with them. By the time you're done with that 10 minutes on the stage that you have, that your instrument will be dust, you know, so you yes. can't ever master it and do it again. Do you know, there's another piece, Stephen, I wonder if you know of it. It is rarely performed. And Cage's first performance of it, I think it was at UC Davis as part of that Satie Me Want a Music Day event. But the piece is called Sound Anonymously Received. And it is essentially a musician receives an instrument from whom he doesn't know, but he receives it anonymously, and he now has 10 minutes on the stage to perform with
this. Nice. I like that.
Beautiful.
And I like it.
The first time Cage ever did it, somebody gave him an empty, I don't know if it was empty, actually, I should check this out, but it was a box of Cracker Jacks. So it was a Cracker Jack box. So it had, you know, the rattle effect you could have, the tearing of paper, you could have munching, you could have all those things, but again, by the time you got to the end of it, it would be gone. It would be destroyed. But also it just confronts that thing in the performer that this person has never performed with this object before. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do now for
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it's so great.
Yeah.
I mean, very often when I teach a lot of improvisation workshops all over the world, and sometimes I work with highly skilled musicians who are going to then give a performance. Sometimes I deal with people who, of many professions, who don't have any particular musical skills. Sometimes they're mixed up. And for people to play, to always have a wonderful supply of rattlers and shakers and cereal boxes and just all kinds of junk that you can play with mm-hmm. is so great. And I really, one of the things that I really like about Cage's ideas in this regard is playing with an instrument where you can't couple the input with the output. You can't predict or control the input with the output. I mean, so often violinists and pianists spend years, you know, practicing and practicing to have control, you know,
right.
so you can produce a particular emotional tone on this C sharp that's different from 20 other emotional tones.
And you can do it reliably.
And you can do it reliably. And of course, what's always interested, I mean, it's great to be able to improvise on an instrument that you know well and that you can do really interesting things with. But what makes it really interesting is when things come out of that instrument that you haven't predicted, that you can't control, okay. that people weren't expecting. I once did a workshop at Arizona State University, hosted by Sam Palafian, who was a extraordinary tuba player. So Sam and I were facing each other in the middle, like I like to teach in big circles, you know, just having students in concentric circles. So there were about 150 students there in concentric circles, and Sam and I were sitting in the middle, and I had my violin, and he had his tuba, and we were talking about things, and the students were trying things. So one young woman raises her hand and asks, well, what happens if you're playing the instrument that you know well, and you know so many things to do with it that it becomes repetitive, and you're sick of that and you want to do something, you want to get out of that rut. And I said, well, it really helps to play on an instrument that you don't know how to play. So Sam immediately, I have this on videotape somewhere, Sam held up his tuba and said to me, do you know how to play one of these? No. And in fact, I've never gotten decent sound out of a wind instrument in my life. It's pathetic. And I held the violin, do you know how to play one of these? No. So we switched right there and we played a duet with me on tuba and him on violin. And I found some weird burbling sounds that I could make. And he found some sounds that he could make. And by listening to each other intently, we actually did an interesting piece. And of course, that's the other thing when you talk about chivalry. Chivalry means actually listening to each other and respecting the other human being, so that in a sense, the other human being, if you want to score, the other human being is a score. Or if you're playing solo, there are still scores all around you, the wind and the breath of people and the way the room sounds and the way you're, even if you're playing your incredibly well-known, well-practiced instrument that you played for years, the way it's going to sound in this room is going to be different from the way it will sound in any other room and people's eyes and everything. So that's why I tend to regard these solo work, you know, I say no solo is solo, that it is always in some ways a collective work.
Right, right. I just find it so interesting that Cage didn't ever really talk in that direction on the subject. Yeah. For him, it was really just all about the solo player. Stephen, it's been absolutely wonderful having you today. Let's close here and move on to some music.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Laura. This has been such a great pleasure.
Stephen, let's begin with your quintet for viola and thrush. Do you remember when you wrote this?
Yes, I remember very well. It was in June of 2020, during the pandemic of 2020 to 2021, and still somewhat in 2022. I had been isolated here at home. I'm lucky enough to have a home. I'm lucky enough to have a home in the woods where I can go walking. And so during this time when I couldn't go, quote, anywhere, end quote, I spent a lot of time in the woods listening to the birds and watching the mushrooms and watching the poplar trees and paying attention to the insects. But the birds were extraordinarily fascinating. And I found I could make recordings of the birds out in the woods, bring them back into the studio, slew them down, drop them 2, 3, 4 octaves, and get these extraordinary sounds that were akin to whale sounds. And I started recording an album called Hermitage of Thrushes for violin, viola, electric violin, viola d'amore, plus all of the thrushes and cardinals and woodpeckers and all kinds of creatures that were out in the woods. And this particular piece is called Quintet for Viola and Thrush because four of the voices were one thrush tweet that weaves in and out of itself in this kind of contrapuntal form. And then I played viola with it. And that's the first piece on the album, Hermitage of Thrushes. And I had so much fun making this. And since then, I've done a lot of other work with birds, with my friend David Rothenberg, with other musicians. It's really, they are so advanced. They are such advanced and interesting musicians, far beyond our knowledge and ability.
Marvelous, Stephen. Let's have a listen.
Thank you.
Now, let's listen to something that couldn't be more different. And this is Stephen's piece. It's called Nai Lama Dodo Tulu. And this is a piece that Stephen wrote very, very, very recently in response to his hearing Cage's realization of his How to Get Started. What an incredibly fun piece, Stephen. You must have enjoyed doing that very, very much. Let's listen to another vocal work. This third piece that we're going to listen to is called Yazo Tondo, and it is, as I say, a vocal piece that Stephen did with our mutual friend Ron Fine. He has a little caveat to add before we listen.
With Yazo Tondo, I know this is on radio, so our listeners can't see the visuals. But if you look for Yazo Tondo on the web, you will find the video of the sound waves of this piece, and it's even more fun when you can see it and hear it.
Here's Yazo Tondo.
Mo ye chamaye mo yazo, mo moje penage no moyazo, jezimetande no moyazo, umpulum.
Alan, cerem.
Moje petaze mo moyazo, zemetando no moyazo, umpulum. Petoze mo moyazo, zeme petando no moyazo, umpulu, elo, elo, mole mendanzo zo yazo, mole mendanzo no yazo, umpulu, umpulu no ma, yemine mambo. Nazo, mele mendando nazo.
The last work we'll listen to of Stevens is Clouds Unfold. Here's what he has to say about it.
Clouds Unfold was another one of my pandemic era pieces. I did it fairly early in 2020. I was playing with these, you know, they have these roly squishy keyboards that have sort of rubberized waves instead of piano keys that you press down. And they're touch sensitive in five different directions. And I was playing with the roly keyboard and a synthesizer called Equator in the computer and violin on top of it. And some effects and electronics, and there we were. And it was, there was this sense of opening and light that was kind of pervading my consciousness at the time that I created this piece. Clouds Unfold, that was a phrase from William Blake, of course.